You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding.
There simply was no clear and present danger of the kind that would justify the aggressive response. Instead, what there is a fear of a new model of the Fourth Estate.
WikiLeaks returned to the news this week with the release of another trove of leaked documents, this time pertaining to information about the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. It might be hard to believe that it's been about a year since the release of the first set of leaked materials. Since then, the content of the leaked materials has sometimes been overshadowed by the story of the leaks themselves. The legality of WikiLeaks' role in bringing these materials to light has been hotly contested. Personality profiles of the man behind WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, are abundant. And meanwhile, reports have shown that the alleged source of the leak, Private First Class Bradley Manning, has been held for months in conditions rivaling or worse than those of the very Guantanamo detainees the recently released leaked documents report on. He has reportedly been forced to sleep naked, held in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day, and randomly woken up during the night, depriving him of sleep. As of this recording, Manning has finally been deemed fit to stand trial, almost a year after his initial arrest. Law professors Yochai Binkler and Bruce Ackerman drafted a letter condemning the treatment on constitutional grounds, which has since been signed by 250 members of the academic community. I recently spoke to Binkler about why he spoke out in defense of Manning and whether WikiLeaks represents any kind of threat to the legal and journalistic status quo.
The treatment here is very hard to explain, at least on the explanations available in public up till now, other than as a pattern of humiliation and degradation. We have said enough. We need a much better explanation. After these stories came out, President Obama came and said his entire response was, I have asked the Pentagon, and they have told me that everything is in order. When you have this level of public discussion on descriptions of what are so clearly inhumane and degrading conditions, you cannot simply say, trust me, it's all going according to procedures. I think people would love to be told then in fact it's all exaggeration, would love to find out that every piece of the treatment is justified. No one, I suspect, who signed that letter, certainly not I, wants to find out that we live in a country where someone can be kept in solitary confinement for 10 months as a deterrent to others without trial. The call in the letter is, tell us, be transparent, explain exactly what's happening, do it in a way that is credible, with some transparent and objective description of the event and analysis of the conditions, rather than this obscure trust us, when by what seems to be reported publicly, the prevention of injury or supposed suicide watch is not what the psychiatrists in the brig itself are recommending, that the actual behavior is completely inconsistent with maximum security designation, which is the cause of this isolation. Instead, what we're seeing is a variety of non-denial denials that try to bob and weave between very narrow distinctions, as well as this grand answer from the president, I've asked the Pentagon and they told me it's okay. I think we've reached a point where that's not enough.
The reasoning behind Bradley Manning's detention seems to be a particular standout here. Is Bradley Manning being used as something of a whipping boy or an example because the administration can't get to their real target, which is WikiLeaks?
I think given the incongruity between what little we know about Bradley Manning's actual danger to himself or others, which seems to be not that high, and the treatment, it's very hard to believe that the treatment is really about preventing him from injuring himself or harming others. So we need to look for some other explanation. And I think the most likely explanation that presents itself until we have some other good evidence is that the Pentagon is using Bradley Manning's treatment as a deterrent against future whistleblowers. Early in 2010, a 2008 Pentagon memo was leaked on WikiLeaks that actually analyzes WikiLeaks itself. And in that memo, the Pentagon report very clearly suggests that they understand WikiLeaks to be primarily a site to achieve transparency and criticism of repressive regimes, but also of corporations and also of the U.S. And they raise the concern that WikiLeaks could be used to embarrass the United States and that there could be embarrassing revelations. When they analyze the potential to prevent WikiLeaks from doing that, they come to the conclusion in that report, whose authenticity has not been doubted, that the only way to do it is to scare whistleblowers out of their minds so that they don't leak things to WikiLeaks. That's the operative conclusion of the 2008 Pentagon report. Now, suddenly, over the course of 2010, we see a context in which the military is barely denying mistreatment, pre-trial, without due process, of an alleged whistleblower, allowing the details to go out, never really denying them. It sounds and looks more like an implementation of that strategy, essentially telling any future whistleblower, forget about due process. Don't fall into our hands. That's fundamentally inconsistent with our system of constitutional protections. You don't violate a person's constitutional protections to due process, to being treated not in ways that are cruel and inhumane for what is essentially punishment before trial, in order to deter others who might leak to a site whose goal is to achieve transparency. This is simply not something that's consistent with our constitutional system. And until we hear otherwise, it is the most plausible interpretation of the facts.
WikiLeaks seems kind of exceptional when it comes to representing whistleblowers and being a clearinghouse for leaked information. But you've said that there's something of an overreaction coming from the Pentagon on how WikiLeaks has done this. What do you mean by that?
I think that as you look carefully at the events of 2010, what becomes very clear is that the United States government responded with what is effectively a panic response to WikiLeaks. Even when the New York Times and WikiLeaks released exactly the same cables online in exactly the same redacted form, the response of the government to the New York Times was entirely consistent with the Pentagon Papers. It was, we'll talk to you about what we think is the trouble, but we understand that you have to go forward and publish. The response to WikiLeaks was exactly the opposite. Senator Clinton called it an attack on the international community. Vice President Biden called Assange more like a high-tech terrorist than the Pentagon Papers. I'm not even talking about the responses from Republicans. There have been massive overclaims and overstatements of the impact of WikiLeaks. For example, after the Afghan war logs were released, Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said WikiLeaks might already have blood on its hands from a soldier or an Afghan family. Secretary Gates said WikiLeaks will cause a disclosure and compromise our methods of operation. But when the Secretary of Defense was asked by the Senate to formally attest by letter to what had happened, he said, well, we're still worried about it, but actually there's no evidence that anything was compromised. And now as we're looking already close to a year since the revelation of the Afghan documents, we see there simply was no clear and present danger of the kind that would justify the aggressive response. Instead, what there is a fear of a new model of the Fourth Estate. The government has come to be comfortable, at least to some extent, with the familiar centralized traditional mass-mediated fourth estate, which sometimes describes things that are inconvenient, but largely is part of a cooperative system in which the press doesn't press too much and the government allows it to press where it does. And sometimes it really leads to big stories like the NSA domestic eavesdropping case. Sometimes it allows for really powerful manipulation, as in the case of the New York Times reporting on WMD in Iraq in support of the war under the Bush administration. And often it's neither of these two extremes. The panic response to WikiLeaks that resulted in these major political statements, followed up by a legal investigation that cannot possibly, under the Constitution, result in anything other than the government dropping the case, is another dimension in which we see this extremely aggressive response towards an organization that is doing nothing different in substance than what its traditional media partners were doing.
And the New York Times has come out and said WikiLeaks is not a journalistic entity, which in some way doesn't allow it to afford itself the same rights that the New York Times is allowed to.
I think the New York Times has issued a variety of different kind of reports. There were, in the reporting side, there were certainly instances where it was very clear that WikiLeaks was very much in a partnership with the New York Times, that WikiLeaks was playing a real role in generating the materials. What happened was that towards the end of December, when the New York Times came out with its book of a collected volume, executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, wrote a front page magazine piece in the New York Times that later on became the introduction to the book, in which he bent over backwards to twice saying Assange was a source, not a partner. Throughout, we treated him as a source, not a partner, which is entirely inconsistent both with the actual practice of how much there was cooperation in terms of what would be released, how it would be redacted, when it would be redacted, not to speak of the fact that WikiLeaks itself throughout this period had done a tremendous amount of cleaning and redacting the information even before the embassy, primarily before the embassy cables. And the tenor of the piece is very hard to interpret except as a parallel panic response by the traditional media, in this case the New York Times, to the panic response of the government, each of them responding to a different way in which this new entity that symbolized the networked fourth estate was threatening the traditional way of doing business. So the government was worried about destabilizing its relatively close relationship with media that it recognized and understood. And it's important to understand this case in the context of the last 2 years of general panic in daily newspapers, that their business model was dying. And in that process of discussing their business model and the threat that the internet presents to the business model of the daily newspaper, investigative journalism became the primary flag or standard waved by the traditional media about what was absolutely critical that they provided to democracy that the internet could not. And it didn't matter that empirically, if you look at the last 10 years, several of the most important stories did come out from internet reporting, the U.S. attorney scandal from Talking Points memo and various others. That didn't matter because it threatened their core claim to be unique and special. What's so dangerous about the way in which the New York Times played out the deprofessionalization, the delegitimization of WikiLeaks as a member of the club is precisely that, at least in the public perception, it made WikiLeaks more vulnerable to the kind of legal attacks and, more importantly, even the extra legal attacks that we saw in the technical and economic payment systems.
You're talking about when PayPal shut down transactions to WikiLeaks and when Amazon...
Among other things, what you had was essentially a public-private partnership in censorship, where because as a constitutional matter, no matter what the New York Times says, as a constitutional matter, you cannot distinguish WikiLeaks from the New York Times. Not because they're foreign, not because they're online, not because they're small and don't have the same organizational structure, and not along the professional and non-professional divide. At each of these layers, the Supreme Court has held in one form or another that that's not a distinction that makes a difference to the question of whether or not the government can clamp down on an organization for publicly publishing materials that might even have been illegally obtained initially. And yet, serving the public interest in knowing and being able to observe and be a watchdog on the government is a sufficiently important interest that it has been deemed to trump all but the most extreme immediate dangers to the public, none of which were involved here, any more than they were in the Pentagon Papers case. So when the path of legal attack is so clearly blocked, what happened was that through a combination of insinuations of illegality that were used then by private parties to justify their actions, and public calls by Senator Lieberman, most powerfully, to private companies, you had a whole slew of private companies denying service to WikiLeaks. Hosting itself, there were denial of service attacks from lots of different places around the world on WikiLeaks. So Amazon, using its power under its standard form contract, shut down service to WikiLeaks so that you couldn't get the materials. WikiLeaks then shifted the hosting materials to a French company called OVH. And then that was shut down because the French Minister of Industry and Finance said, you have to shut it down. So then it moves to Sweden. And there the Pirate Party hosted it for a while, and then many mirrors were created throughout the world to be resilient. What's interesting in this domain is that even though it was constitutionally impermissible, if the United States government had gone to a court and asked for an injunction to say, Amazon, stop hosting, the court would have said, no, you cannot block access to the information because of the First Amendment. Instead, the insinuation of illegality in a letter from the State Department, in public speeches, was used by private parties to say, well, we don't want to host illegal materials. And that succeeded in achieving something that the government couldn't achieve constitutionally. You move from hosting to DNS service. And with DNS service, again, you plug in WikiLeaks.org and you don't get there because every DNS says, we're no longer going to point at WikiLeaks.org. So again, what rides into the rescue is the Swiss DNS server. So WikiLeaks.ch is available, and then people point in various different places. Again, what happens is some organization, in this case in Switzerland, not in Sweden, says, it's not my job to censor. It's my job to tell a computer that says, where should I go when I plug in WikiLeaks.ch, where they should go to get the materials that they want. That's my role as a DNS service provider, not as a private enforcer. And then the same thing happened with Apple, that pulled an app store. There was an application, an app that was developed by a Russian developer, not related to WikiLeaks at all, for reading the cables. And Apple removed it from the app store. Then you move to payment systems. A vice president of PayPal specifically said there was a November 27th letter from the State Department that said that what WikiLeaks was doing was illegal, so we had no choice. We stopped serving them. Now, the letter itself, actually, signed by Harold Koh, legal advisor to the State Department, was a very careful piece of lawyering that didn't at any point say that what WikiLeaks was doing was illegal. But it insinuated it, so that unless you do the careful lawyering of reading through it, you came away with the impression that WikiLeaks did something illegal without the state ever saying so, which they couldn't say because of the First Amendment. And so PayPal and MasterCard and Visa and later Bank of America and the Swiss bank that held the Swiss bank account, the private account of Assange, all shut down services. And at least according to a communication that Assange made about this, it looks like 80 to 90% of donation flow was cut off. So that was a system that couldn't be worked around. So essentially what you got here, when you look from hosting to DNS service, to app service, to payment systems, what you got here was a multi-system attack over a privately owned infrastructure of communications and payment that was aimed to achieve precisely the result that the First Amendment in the United States says the United States government cannot achieve, which is to shut down access to the materials. In this regard, what the story tells us is both about the particular vulnerability of the networked fourth estate to attacks from this public-private partnership, and on the other hand, the enormous resilience that it nonetheless has from the presence of a global distributed series of backups that flow from one country to another, that actually many of them are resources that were developed during the culture wars around music distribution and copyright, that then get brought to bear on the question of censorship with regard to political communication. And that becomes, that global distributed network ends up in this case becoming more important to the resilience of free speech and the networked fourth estate than the true fact that the U.S. Constitution also protects it, but it ends up being peripheral to the actual capability of accessing the materials.
You describe the networks of power, the quote-unquote legitimate power, who have some sort of legal authority, or at the very least have the ears of the folks with the switches, going up against the folks who are able to use the power of the net to go around. How can we make sure that WikiLeaks and the resilience of the net can come back into the system and participate legitimately? Will there always be this kind of tension if we have these kinds of leaks in the future?
Always is a very long time. I think that it's important to recognize that part of what we learned from the WikiLeaks case is that there is a productive partnership to be had between distributed networked media and traditional professional commercial media. Let's not forget that, at least from the release of the Afghan war logs, there was a developing, difficult, painful, clearly from the descriptions at least of people on the traditional media side, painful and difficult collaboration between WikiLeaks and The Guardian and The New York Times and Der Spiegel and El País and Le Monde. These were difficult relations, but they were relations that made each party better and made the whole disclosure cleaner, more effective, more transparent, more useful. And so it's important to recognize the story is not one of a dying traditional media and a resilient networked media. It's actually the beginning of the emergence of a synthesis between what we always talk about as citizen media versus what we always talk about mainstream media. Instead, what you see is actually the very difficult process of collaboration, just like we saw it 10 years ago when IBM and other companies began to recognize, hey, free software, open source software is not way out there, crazy anti-market. It's actually something we can build a collaboration with. Because it happened a decade earlier, because it was more technologically sophisticated, we now have many of those kinks ironed out. There are costs, there are benefits, there are costs to open source software, there are costs to traditional companies, there are enough benefits to overcome it. I think what this event, series of events, shows us is that there's tremendous room for a productive partnership between distributed, global, decentralized citizen media and traditional media, some of them more regional, but mostly on a global level, at the highest level, some for-profit, like the New York Times or Der Spiegel, others non-profit, like The Guardian, or government-funded, like the BBC, that together bring some of the benefits in terms of accreditation and mass attention that the traditional media bring. Whether it's WikiLeaks or the people with video phones on Tahrir Square, it doesn't matter. You're talking about the benefits of a distributed media and a centralized media in partnership. This case, the WikiLeaks case, is very much the Pentagon Papers case of our generation. If Upton Sinclair and the jungle were the point at which investigative journalism really became the thing that you understood newspapers to be around, about, and the Pentagon Papers case was the moment at which the constitutional order of the United States said, we understand the risks of a free press, and we're willing to accept them as in order to get the transparency we need with regard to our government. What the WikiLeaks case does is say to us, we're now moving into a new phase. Not a phase of completely distributed anarchic media, but a phase of partnership between the distributed and the traditional. And that in working that out, we have enormous threat to what was seen as the established way of doing it. And that threat is both to the New York Times and to the government, and we saw both of their panicked responses. And at the same time, we see that part of what is that threat is the ability to mobilize private resources to achieve things the government is not allowed to do constitutionally. And at the same time, the ability to harness social resources by WikiLeaks to actually be resilient to that private attack. But the shift moves from a dramatic court case that goes all the way to the Supreme Court within days, and you get a constitutional decision and everything is over, which is the Pentagon case, to a push-me-pull-you contested battle between private parties, some of them acting in the market, some of them acting in society in a non-market way, to resolve the same questions around what is basically a constitutional structure still committed to freedom in this case, but not really being effective either at constraining the government or at freeing WikiLeaks.
I wonder if the constitutional legitimacy is enough for this case. In the case of WikiLeaks, I wonder if they're enough of a journalistic entity to, you know, pull this off, because on the other side, the argument is that WikiLeaks stands for radical transparency, and whatever documents they get their hands on are then dumped. Now, they've worked that out a little bit with their partnerships with traditional news media by allowing them to bring the context and the editorial authority over it. But if we afford WikiLeaks the same, you know, journalistic entity status that New York Times gets, is that then an argument for radical transparency?
This has absolutely nothing to do with radical transparency. The freedom of the press to publish leaks, the freedom of the press to publish even materials that were obtained illegally by whoever leaked it to them, is built not on an ideology of radical transparency. It's built on the idea that it is the role of the government to protect what it deems secret carefully. And it is the role of the press, when occasionally, stochastically, we get a light shining in, to shine that light. The way that system works is not that everything government does is radically in the public eye. That's nonsense. WikiLeaks can't publish things that aren't leaked to it. The correct response of the government is to keep things from leaking. What happens, though, and the reason that leaks are so important, is that the fact that in the back of their minds, government officials know that nothing is for sure secret creates a disciplining effect on government officials operating behind the veil to conform themselves to behavior that, broadly speaking, they would be willing to have exposed to the public. It doesn't always work. There are certain things that need to be kept secret. All of that may be true. But the system is not one of radical transparency. It never has been with regard to leaks. It couldn't possibly become with WikiLeaks. It's a system of protecting the ability to shine the light very heavily, stochastically or randomly, on occasion, like spot checks to figure out whether somebody is doing their work properly. You don't tell them when you're going to check them, and then suddenly you check, and they know constantly that they have to conform to at least some plausible standard. That's the way in which the relationship between leaks and the Fourth Estate has worked. It's not radical transparency. It's occasional transparency that then is intended to chill illegal or inappropriate behavior on the side of the government. So you place the risk on the person who has access to the information because it's illegal for them to leak. And you put them in the position where they say, is this something that shocks my conscience so much that I'm willing to take a risk to release it? But then you don't clamp down on the media that releases it. And if ultimately you find that there's a very discreet revelation of something that's illegal, you also protect the whistleblower.
So does WikiLeaks constitute a unique legal precedent to things that have happened in the past, to Pentagon Papers?
I don't think that WikiLeaks represents a legal precedent at all. I think if the Justice Department does end up pursuing WikiLeaks, it will be an important precedent that will establish that the decentralized media in fact enjoy all of the Fourth Estate. It's extremely difficult, short of the kind of panic response we saw from the government, to imagine that a court would overturn its precedents with regard to small media, with regard to what counts as a journalist or journalism, that it would find WikiLeaks liable. Just imagine for a moment that a soldier had walked out instead of with those materials to this site, same materials to a small town newspaper in Oklahoma that might have one or two employees, even fewer and less ability to filter out than WikiLeaks. Would we possibly imagine that a court would say, well, you don't have checks and balances like the New York Times, so I'm sorry, local newspaper, no First Amendment for you? It's nonsense. It simply wouldn't happen. And that's the claim primarily against WikiLeaks, that it's not structured like a traditional medium. But so are many small papers. You couldn't possibly distinguish it on those grounds. And so I think if there will be a legal precedent, it will be one that will establish very clearly that that distributed online media are like journalists for purposes of distributing leaks. However, I don't think it'll get to that, because I think that people in the Justice Department, as they work through the precedents, as they work through the legal arguments, will understand this. In that case, the story becomes less of a legal precedent and more of a framing narrative, a story that helps us very clearly understand the transition moment we're in and the shape of that transition. And in that regard, I think it will be remembered alongside the Pentagon Papers case and the publication of The Jungle as a moment. And remember, The Jungle is not about a legal precedent. It's about a particular moment where suddenly you look and say, ah, that's what journalism is about. I think this will be like that kind of aha moment where we'll come back to that story and say, that's what the networked Fourth Estate is about. That's what it looks like. Those are the benefits of this new form of collaboration. Those are the vulnerabilities. Those are the resiliences. That's what the government has to begin to get used to, so that it doesn't keep responding with this panic response again the next time that it happens.
Yochai Benkler, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Yochai Benkler teaches law at Harvard Law School and is faculty co-director of the Berkman Center. You can find out more about him and the WikiLeaks case at the show notes at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This week's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.